Oyez, 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 Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Thank you, Mr. Pitt. Okay, hello, my name is Shari Kelly, and I, along with my colleagues, Justice Maggie Ellis and Justice Woody Jones, welcome you to the Third Court of Appeals. Today's proceedings are being broadcast live on YouTube. That recording will be available later on the court's YouTube channel, and an audio recording of today's argument will be available later on our court's website. So we'll hear arguments this afternoon in case number 0324-0042 CVPJS versus KSS. Counsel for each side, please state your appearance by giving us your name and your client's names or identifying initials.
Rebecca Gonzalez-Rivas for appellant Patrick Starley.
Your Honor, I'm Jake Gilbert for appellee Katie Starley.
And then for appellant, could you please say your last name again? It's Rivets?
Gonzalez-Rivas.
Gonzalez-Rivas, yes. Okay.
R-I-V-A-S.
Okay, and counsel for appellant, how much time are you reserving for rebuttal?
5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Okay. And so, counsel for both sides, please be aware that the yellow light indicates that you have 2 minutes left, and when the red light comes on, your time is up. And counsel for appellant, when you're ready, you may proceed with your opening 15 minutes.
May it please the court. When Katie and Patrick divorced, they retained certain oil and gas partnership interests. The question before this court is how to apply their contractual formula for dividing the net profits from those interests. The trial court misinterpreted the contract and granted summary judgment to Katie. This court should reverse that summary judgment for three reasons. First, payments under sections 4.4 and 4.5 can only come from net profits. Second, Katie's rights are expressly subordinate to the rights of the creditors. And third, Katie's reading of the contract ignores both the express aim of the contract and the context surrounding its execution. First, Katie is only owed a payment in months in which there are net profits. Two provisions of the contract govern how Katie can receive payments from the partnership interests. Under section 4.4B, Katie is entitled to 50% of the net profits from operating distributions. Net profits is a defined term under the contract. In case a visual is helpful, in tab one of your bench exhibit, we've laid that formula out for you. Patrick takes the operating distribution from the partnership, that's the cash distributed to Patrick, and he has to make several deductions. He needs to pay any capital contributions, any expenses, and any required payments to four of the couple's creditors. What's left over are the net profits from operating distributions, 50% of which Katie is entitled to. Under section 4.5, Patrick makes an additional promise.
So, Ms. Gonzalez-Rivas, so your demonstrative that you're referencing, it suggests that if there are no net profits during the month, that husband has no obligation to make any guaranteed payments, but the PID does not say if there are no net profits, husband has no obligation to make guaranteed payments. So can you explain how that interpretation is consistent with the plain language?
Yes, Your Honor. So our position is that the contract limits the payments under 4.5 to net profits. Three places within the plain text of the contract limit the pool to net profits. First, both the title and text of section 4.5 provide that Katie has a payment right to guarantee of net profits from operating distributions. Only if the operating distributions exceed required payments are there net profits. Only if there are net profits does Katie receive a payment. Second, there are multiple subordination clauses within the contract. In tab 4 of your bench exhibit, we've laid those out for you. For instance, in section 4.4, Katie has acknowledged that she has no rights and funds needed for the required payments. She's otherwise subordinate to the creditors. That goes on in 4.5 as well as in the amended privateer agreement. Importantly for this subordinating language, the contract makes clear that Katie's payment rights are subordinate to the creditors. If Patrick was obligated to pay both Katie and the creditors every month from his separate property, then Katie is on equal footing with the creditors. Every month in which Patrick has to pay Katie out of his separate property, he's decreasing his separate assets, risking further payments to the creditors.
And by subordinate, you referring to the subject to?
I'm referring to, Your Honor, on tab 4, both section 4.4, it says otherwise subordinate to the rights of, and then yes, in 4.5, subject to any obligation, which I'll take priority over. And then in the amended privateer agreement, which was an agreement executed contemporaneously with the contract and required by one of the couple's creditors, Katie again acknowledged and ratified that privateer had priority over Katie for those payments.
Those two provisions have to be read together, right?
I'm sorry?
Those two provisions have to be read together, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. And the third reason I wanted to lay out to Justice Ellis's question of why we know that the relevant pool here is net profits is within the contract, Article 4 states the express aim. That's to, quote, accomplish an equal 50-50 division of the community assets and liabilities. So Katie and Patrick were aiming for this 50-50 split, and they even included a true-up formula within the contract to make sure that at the end of the day, when the assets are sold and liquidated, Katie and Patrick are each getting this 50-50.
But doesn't the contract contemplate there won't be a 50-50 split? For example, there's a ceiling for the amount that Katie can receive and a floor. So why have a ceiling or a floor if the goal is just a 50-50 split down the line?
Two responses, Your Honor. First, I think that the ceiling and that, you know, floor, so to speak, are offsetting the risk for Patrick. So Patrick, in managing these assets, is responsible for both managing the interests, paying off the community debt that is associated to these interests. In months in which net profits are sky high, yes, Katie gets a cap, but in months in which net profits fall below a set amount, Patrick will pay Katie a share of his net profits. And then in terms of the second reason for why, you know, we're getting to this 50-50, it's important to remember that under the contract, Katie has rights to both operating distributions and ultimately a liquidating distribution. So when the asset is sold, Katie will get 50% of that overall liquidating distribution, which is trued up. Importantly, for both Katie's interpretation and the trial court's judgment, an out-of-pocket payment by Patrick is not included within that true-up formula. So here the parties have gone to the trouble of getting to this 50-50, truing it all up, and then Patrick could potentially be out of pocket an additional $1.5 million that he's never compensated for. That goes against the contract's language, and the trial court's judgment must be reversed on that point.
To follow up a little bit on my earlier question, not only do that provision of 4.4, not only does that have to be read in conjunction with 4.5, it also has to be read in conjunction with the amended privateer agreement, does it not?
Yes, Your Honor, that's our position. They were executed contemporaneously as part of the divorce. They pertain to the same transaction, and so we'd ask the court to read them together. That paragraph 8 in the amended privateer agreement, you know, is again another express subordination. And the reason, the context behind why the parties had to enter into the amended privateer agreement was when the parties divorced, that triggered a default under the original privateer agreement. So privateer, one of the couple's creditors, could have called in that loan. To avoid that implication, privateer had Katie and Patrick execute an amended privateer agreement, ratifying that privateer would get paid before Katie did. There was clear concern both between the parties and the couple's creditors about the creditworthiness of this estate. Patrick has, even though this investment has not performed as well as expected, Patrick has continued to pay the required payments to the creditors out of pocket, over $1.7 million and over $2.2 million in capital contributions out of pocket, in order to keep this investment afloat, keep the community estate afloat, and ensure that Katie will retain an interest in this investment so that one day, when it is lucrative, both of them will get a large lump payment when it's liquidated.
Was the privateer agreement part of the summary judgment proceeding?
The privateer agreement, Your Honor, was not part of the original summary judgment motion. after the summary judgment motion by Patrick was denied, an intervener, the trust, the KSS 2011 Irrevocable Trust, attached it to their intervener brief. We attached it in our motion for reconsideration. I believe it was attached again in the motion for new trial. And when the trial court ultimately denied all of those things, she said on the face of the order, after consideration of all of these documents. So we believe it's before the court.
I think in your brief, you argued correctly that the facts and circumstances surrounding the parties' negotiations have to be considered. And also that I believe that the term was the privateer required the amended privateer agreement, which makes sense. Is there evidence in the record about, there are three provisions, 4.4, 4.5, and the privateer amended privateer agreement, that all use similar, and in some cases almost identical language, subordination, priority over, et cetera. Is there any evidence in the summary judgment record about the extent to which privateer required those provisions?
So we know from the record, Your Honor, that yes, privateer and the trust were involved in the drafting of the contract. So, you know, we know from the record that this was a negotiated clause. As Your Honor has pointed out, it's quite similar to the language that privateer required them to agree to in the amended privateer agreement.
Was there any reason for privateer to protect what I'll name as husband, Patrick? Was there any reason they would protect husband?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, what I'm getting at is privateer required these three very similar provisions to protect itself, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So why would it care? As long as they got paid first, mm-hmm. before any money was going to be paid to wife, why would they care if husband got paid anything or not?
I see what Your Honor is asking. So the reason that privateer is concerned about its position as to Katie is that privateer and the couple's other creditors have loaned out significant amounts of money to the marital estate. We're talking, you know, $1 million, $1.1 million, et cetera. I think the concern from privateer was that this is an estate with a significant amount of debt. Under the trial court's judgment, Patrick would be out up to another $1.5 million. And so the subordination language is to make clear that Katie cannot be paid until the creditors have been paid. Again, I think the difference in our positions, Your Honor, boils down to what is the pool of money that 4.5 relates to? The contract, in several instances, shows us that the pool of money are the net profits. Katie's interpretation is she gets a spousal payment every month of $11,500, regardless of where that comes from. I additionally wanted to just note for the court, I know from Katie's briefing that there's been a lot of focus around the word guarantee. We've also paid a lot of attention to that word, but we'd like to flag the Coker v. Coker decision out of the Texas Supreme Court, very factually similar. In Coker, we also saw a divorce settlement agreement. The husband agreed to pay the wife his real estate, the husband agreed to give the wife his real estate commissions, and he said further in the agreement, if for any reason the wife does not receive his real estate commissions, he will pay the wife up to a guaranteed sum of $25,000. The Supreme Court reversed summary judgment for the wife and made two critical points here. First, to the extent that the contract is construed as a guarantee agreement, any uncertainty must be resolved in favor of the guarantor. Second, it was at least ambiguous that the husband intended to guarantee commissions that he himself had not yet received. So too here, it is at least ambiguous that Patrick could have intended to guarantee net profits that he himself has not received. And if this court concludes that this is a guarantee contract and there's any uncertainty, it must resolve it in favor of Patrick.
That case is cited in your brief, is it not?
It is, yes, Your Honor.
And the language in before us is up to? Does that include the up to language?
Yes, I can pull the exact language if you'd like, Your Honor. Just one moment. He hereby guarantees to wife that she will receive the said sum of $25,000 from Majors & Majors or from any other payer, and then skipping forward, in the event, for any reason, she fails to receive such installments of commission exactly as husband would have prior to his assignment of his rights thereto to wife, husband agrees to pay to wife in Dallas County, Texas, all such sums of money which she has failed to receive up to the guaranteed sum of $25,000.
Shifting to the attorney's fees for a moment, if we disagree with you on the merits, don't we have to affirm the entire fee award since Katie would be the prevailing party?
Yes, Your Honor. If this court affirms summary judgment for Katie's position, both parties agree that the family code rises and falls with the appeal. The Section 6.5 contract award that the trial court awarded should be reversed, should not be awarded.
Okay. So then if we agree with you on that, if we believe she prevails on the underlying summary judgment, but we believe your argument on that he's not in violation of providing, you know, documents under the contract, then what do we do?
Because those were alternative bases for attorney's fees, Your Honor,
okay.
If Katie prevails on the appeal, she would prevail on attorney's fees, okay, under the family code.
I yes. Misunderstood your answer for a second.
I don't think it was particularly clear, okay, Your Honor. In my last 20 seconds, I'll just point out that Katie has not disputed that her reading would yield an inequitable division in her favor under that 50-50 division of community assets and liabilities. And as we pointed out, this court should construe the language alongside the amended privateer agreement. The only way to maintain the creditworthiness of this estate was by guaranteeing the timely repayment of all debts ahead of any payment to Katie.
Thank you. Kelly?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. I believe this case is about the interpretation of a formula, and I believe it to be a clear interpretation. And as Justice Ellis pointed out, the plain reading of the formula contained in Section 4.5 of the party's agreement to divorce. The trial court found the language under 4.5 to be clear and unambiguous in that Katie is entitled to a guaranteed amount of $11,000 per month under a clear and unambiguous formula. Going through our presentation, it's important, I think, as background to walk through various payments that are required by Patrick Starley under the partition agreement or agreement incident to divorce. And Justice Jones, to your point, there is a third party in the background of here, privateer specifically, and it makes logical sense given how the structure of the agreement is, and the words subordination or are subject to are continuously used throughout the agreement. If you contrast that, and actually if you look at the required payments, and this is on page 3 of the presentation, when we talk about net profits and how net profits are calculated under the partition agreement, it specifically speaks to required payments, and it says net profits means an amount equal to the profit realized by Patrick Starley from any liquidating distributions or operating distributions after the return of all capital contributions and the payment of all actual expenses and liabilities and assets from which liquidating or operating distributions, as well as all the required payments. Again, that language is specific.
A question about that. So would you say that Section 4.5 is somewhat circular? The net profits already account for the required payments, but Section 4.5 states the guaranteed payments over and above net profits are made subject to required payments.
Yes.
How do we harmonize this?
Well, I think you harmonize it by when we talk about, you compare the language from 4.5 to the language for 4.4 to 4.5. When we're calculating net profits, we talk about specifically in that formula, we are going to deduct after the payment of, right? We're making payments of expenses, liabilities, we're making payments of required payments, and that may very well result in a positive. It may very well wipe it out completely. Right, but there could be a positive. There could be a positive of $19,000. There could be a positive of $80,000. And to Justice Kelly's point, that's one of the reasons why we have this structure, and it's a contrast to saying, well, we're trying to achieve a 50-50 division. There's a ceiling for Katie all throughout the partition agreement. There's a ceiling when it comes to liquidating distributions. There's a ceiling when it comes to operating distributions of $20,000 a month. And so to get to net profits first, that's when we're deducting. This goes to their second point, right? Their second point is essentially if the required payments essentially come off the guaranteed amount. And that's not what it says. It says more to Justice Jones's point of it's subordinate. It is privateers out there, they want to get paid first. And the evidence in the record is that privateers out there is making sure whatever y'all do, whatever the Starleys do, privateer comes first. And it's no different than a first mortgage, right? If I go to Chase Bank and I get a mortgage on my house and I say, okay, I'm also going to get a second mortgage, Chase Bank would tell me that's fine, but I'm first, right? Your second mortgage, be it from Citibank or IBC or what have you, that is going to be subordinate to me. And Patrick's argument is essentially saying, hey, my second mortgage, I can tell my second mortgage company there's not enough money to pay you this month, and not, well, hey, you know, that's it when you sue your second. But Patrick's position is, I get to deduct the first payment from you, second mortgage, because you're subordinate, right? You owe your second mortgage regardless if there's a pool of money. So to Justice Jones, back to your point too, why would we have this subordinate language in here? Why would we have that? It goes down to what if there's a foreclosure? What if a creditor comes and sues? Privateer is a third party negotiating, as counsel acknowledged, negotiating as part of this agreement, and they want to make sure, in fact, the record indicates insisted, and you can see from the intervention, insisted we come first. It does not change, though. It does not change the clear formula in Section 4.5. And that goes to the first point that counsel was making, saying their first argument.
When Ms. Gonzalez-Rivas, she brought up the Coker opinion and as it relates to guarantee.
Right.
How do you distinguish this case?
I don't think you necessarily have to. We certainly pointed out in reading the language, it says guarantee, right? So if we're trying to figure out what these folks were trying to decide, it says guarantee. I'm not arguing that it falls. Rises and falls on that word guarantee. That's end of story because it says guarantee. What's the end of story is the plain language, Justice Ellis, as you pointed out, the plain formula that's in Section 4.5. It says plainly, Patrick Starley will pay the difference, if any, between the applicable guaranteed amount and the amount of net profits from operating distributions. It does not say only if there are net profits. It does not say if it's $1, then it's a different amount. If it's zero, then all of a sudden I'm out of luck. If there's no, it says there's a guarantee amount. Again, Justice Ellis, to your question, I don't think I win absolutely because it says guaranteed. I think we win absolutely because of the plain language. And when you review the record in the trial court, the argument, and this is the primary argument made in the briefing, is to, again, Justice Jones's point of this language, a subject to any obligation to make required payments. That, at the trial level, and you read the summary judgment responses and the record before the court, that's where Patrick Starley largely hung his hat, was saying this subject to any obligation to make required payments. And the argument at the trial level, which the trial court agreed with, and the argument to this honorable court, is that that is a subjugation language. That is a subjugation language because privateers out there, because there's other third-party creditors out there. This estate, as counsel acknowledged, does have creditors out there. There could be foreclosures. There could be lawsuits. And all the Starley creditors out there want to know and were part of the negotiation that they come first. That is exactly what this language does. It says that there's a certain pool of money and we're all lining up to sue Patrick Starley. Privateers first, the required payments are first, but the idea that we can wipe out required payments, use that to wipe out net operating profits and say, well, therefore you get zero, despite the fact that the formula says minus actually received. That is the language from the contract.
Mr. Goodbreath, do you have any cases that we can turn to help us interpret what take priority over means? I know you've argued plain meaning, but is there anything that we can turn to for specifically what does take priority to...
Right. Upon review, Justice Kelly, I didn't find any specific on-point cases. That's why I did pull Black's Law's Dictionary. You could pull Webster's Dictionary, what have you. A little bit, frankly speaking, and I had this approach of the trial court, is I'm up here with the easy argument because, to Justice Ellis's point, I believe plain language. I believe it's absolutely plain language. You can type out the formula that's contained in Section 4.5. And maybe the number is zero that you plug in, right? And again, Justice Kelly, to your point, when counsel says, well, we're just trying to achieve a 50-50 division, there's no way under this agreement you could possibly say, well, we know we're going to receive a 50-50 division. There are various true-ups and what have you, but there's also caps, there's ceilings. Mr. Starley could have a liquidating distribution of $50 million, right? And Katie's capped at $20 million as far as liquidating distributions. I'm sorry, she's capped at $5 million from the liquidating distributions.
And do you agree or disagree that we can consider the privateer agreement?
I don't believe that was part of the summary judgment record. I'd have to go back and look. But I do believe it's helpful, though, to review context, because I do actually think it supports in helping explain the language of subject to any obligations, right? When you're thinking, Justice Kelly, of why do they have what we say plain meaning, according to Black's Law Dictionary, Webster's Dictionary, whatever you want to ask, is that this means that it's not that I don't owe the funds, right? You have this all through family law, for example, right? Like, my child support takes part. I have to pay my child support. I may have a defense to contempt if I can't pay my child support. It doesn't go away, right? I may not be able to pay my second mortgage and I'm paying my first mortgage first. That doesn't mean I don't owe my second mortgage anymore. It just means who lines up to sue me first.
So,
and there is no lawsuit from privateer in this.
Following up on Justice Kelly's question, are you saying that we can we consider any evidence presented, or are we limited to what was presented summary judgment?
If I could pause and make sure I'm thinking through that, Justice Ellison. So the summary judgment evidence essentially said you do not get to deduct required payments, because that was the argument, right? And our motion for summary judgment said that essentially was establishing the formula. So I don't believe there'd be any evidence before the trial court. Frankly, I'd have to study the record a little more in detail. But essentially, by the time you get past summary judgment and the trial court has said, this is your formula through summary judgment, this is plain and unambiguous language, this is your formula, the trial was easy, right? Because the party stipulated, and this is in the record, the party stipulated that there had been $0 in net profits from operating distributions paid to Katie. So at that point, all you're doing is taking $11,500, multiplying times the amount of months that have been sued, and that's how the trial court reached her judgment. And then, of course, there's testimony regarding attorney's fees. Your actual record contains a lot of other issues that weren't appealed. There's a suit on unreimbursed medical expenses, for example. They had various other financial disputes. But the Section 4.5, I would say the way I would describe the procedure is summary judgment established as a matter of law, the formula, right? And the formula that the trial court found is the formula that we set forth in our presentation, which is the formula set forth in Section 4.5. And then you plug in, hey, we stipulated zero. We have $11,500 per month. We have this many months that we're sued on. And therefore, this is the amount that's owed. And then there's testimony about attorney's fees, which, Justice Kelly, to your point, although I think counsel agrees, they were stipulated as reasonable and necessary. And we argued that they were mandatory under the partition agreement. The trial court agreed that they were mandatory. Irrespective, the court is authorized with a may under the Texas Family Code when it comes to attorney's fees. And so if the trial court's award or judgment is affirmed by this court, then there would be no reason to review attorney's fees, because the court was certainly in her discretion, either as a shall or under the contract, or a may under the family code to award the attorney's fees.
I may have misheard you, but did you say that the amended privateer agreement was not part of the summary judgment record?
I'd have to look, Justice Jones. I can't tell you off the top of my head on it. The intervention came after the summary judgment. So procedurally, you had a summary judgment filed by Katie Starley. Both sides actually filed competing summary judgments. The trial court awarded or granted Katie Starley's summary judgment, which, like I was telling Justice Ellis, I believe sets your formula. After the fact, privateer came in, and I believe it's titled KSS Trust, which is just Mr. Starley, but he's the I would say an alter ego of him, but other third parties came in and intervened at that point and filed various motions to reconsider, and those were denied. So as far as your record and evidence in front of the court, testimony, exhibits put forth, I don't believe that's part of your record, but I would have to check, Your Honor.
So just so we're clear, if we accept Ms. Gonzalez-Rivas, his representation that it was only attached in the motion for reconsideration, is it your position that we can consider that or can't consider that?
I believe you wouldn't be considering it, Your Honor, because this is after the summary judgment was granted by the trial court. And so it's not asking to, it's essentially your judgment has already passed from the trial court at that point. I believe that your record.
Even if the judge in her ruling says, I've considered all the documents that were submitted and I'm denying summary judgment, but can't we infer that she used that as to help inform her decision before right. making a decision?
I frankly don't have her letter ruling in front of me. I do believe that there was boilerplate language on that, but procedurally speaking, it came after an order was signed on the granting of the summary judgment on Katie Starley's.
But not before the final judgment.
Yes, sir. That's correct. Right. And because the final judgment was applying the formula to it. And so after the formula is set with the summary judgment, you have privateer coming in and trying to arm wrestle and change the formula. So procedurally, that's the way it proceeded, Justice Jones.
Also, for what it's worth, there are a lot of Texas cases that talk about the phrase take priority over, but almost all of them are cases involving liens. Senior lien, junior lien.
Right. And I think by analogy, and I should have been more clear when we talk about family law cases as far as subordination or what have you. But when you talk about the analogy, that is why we made the analogy to like a second lien and subordination. And when you consider privateer, I think it makes logical sense. These folks could have very easily contracted to say, look, you only, Katie, you only get half of net operating profits that's paid to Patrick Starley. That's not what the language says. It's actually, you subtract the amount paid to Katie Starley. You look at it from Katie Starley. How many dollars did she receive? And you subtract that, not how many dollars Patrick Starley received. And they could have easily said, y'all just split up net operating profits. Whatever they are, split up net operating profits, 50-50. Or you could even say, and this goes to kind of the flow chart that counsel provided, I think in tab two, you could even say, too, it's like whatever the net operating profits are, Katie Starley gets every single dollar up to $11,500, and then you split. You could say that as well. If the actual net operating profits received by Patrick Starley is what they were dividing up. But rather, they do divide them up, but only if we exceed that guaranteed amount, right? It goes back to Justice Kelly's point of the floor and the ceiling. Katie has a ceiling, she also has a floor. And they could have certainly done away with a ceiling and a floor and just said, we're taking net profits and we're dividing them up, or we're taking net profits, we're pooling it, and we're throwing all the money at privateer first, and then we're throwing all the money at this bank and that bank, and then if there's anything left over, y'all, we're dividing that up. That's not what they say. They say, look at the money that Katie actually received. That's the language. Pay the difference of the applicable guaranteed amount in the amount of net profits from operating distributions actually paid to Katie Starley. You look at it from her perspective, and that's your formula. And her perspective is she receives $0.00. That's stipulated in it. And so she does get to trigger her floor, no different than Patrick Starley would certainly be just triggering the ceiling had net operating profits been in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
This may not make any difference, but the phraseology I thought was interesting is actually received in the prior month. Does that make any difference in the formula?
I thought through that why they would look at that. I don't think it makes it any difference, but I do think you guard a little bit if you sort of think about the gamesmanship that could happen with Patrick Starley. For example, when they say, well, there's no payment to Katie unless there's net operating profits, right? Well, if you're Patrick Starley, if you take their approach, what you could do is, I know I have $300,000 coming in. I'm going to slow pay it, and make it all come in 1 month. And then to Justice Kelly's point, I'm capped. If I'm Katie, I'm capped that month. And so I think the reason why it doesn't make sense the way they're saying it, And so there have to be net operating profits. That one, the plain language, to Justice Ellis's point, the plain language doesn't say that. But two, it could result in gamesmanship from Mr. Starley. I'm going to push everything into a single month as far as net operating profits because I know that Katie has a cap, right? She has a cap of $20,000. So rather than spread it out over various months or when it comes in, I'm going to jam it all in 1 month, and then Katie's capped at $20,000, and I get everything else. So all these context clues, everything from privateer, I think all this goes into why the four corners of the document make sense. Personally, I believe, and we argued on appeal into the trial court, the four corners of the analysis could stop with the four corners. You just simply look, and I think this is what the trial court did, type out your formula, we stipulated zero, that's it, guys. You guys can say, well, we didn't mean that, or we thought differently, or in my heart of hearts, I meant that. Those are not what the words say, right? And I think that's why the trial court's summary judgment granting was appropriate. And then again, at the trial level, we're simply plugging in the stipulated amount of net profits paid to Katie. Again, looking at Katie, which is $0.00, and it's just math at that point. And then apply a attorney's fees analysis like the trial court did. I see they have 1 minute and 20 seconds left if there's any further questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, counsel for the appellant, you have 5 minutes left for rebuttal when you're ready.
I'd like to make 2 points in response, Your Honor. First, Katie spoke about that it would have been easy to contract for something different. We agree. Katie is simply after a guaranteed payment of $11,500 as a spousal obligation every month. The parties could have easily contracted for that. These parties know how to split assets. Katie gets this car, Patrick gets this car. The way they could have contracted for this is to say, we will partition the partnership interest to Patrick. Patrick will assume all of the risk associated with the investment and all of the net profits. Separate line, Patrick will pay Katie $11,500 every month. They didn't do that. Katie wanted to be part of this investment. Patrick and Katie chose in Article 4 to join together in a shared investment as a forward-looking business venture. Katie got the potential upside of higher net profits that comes with that choice. She also accepted the risk that net profits would not be as high. The second point I'd like to make, Your Honor, is opposing counsel has spoken about their priority explanation at length. Ultimately, we seem to agree that Katie is subordinate to the creditors. Where we disagree is on what the pool of money is. Again, if the court could turn to tab 3 of the bench exhibits, I think it's helpful to put some numbers to what this looks like under the formula when we understand that net profits are the relevant pool. I think example A and example C are more straightforward, so I'll focus on example B. In example B, operating distributions have exceeded required payments and other necessary deductions, so we have net profits this month. We have $20,000 of net profits. Under 4.4B, Katie is entitled to 50% of those net profits. So here we have Patrick and Katie splitting the $20,000, 10 and 10. But here, Katie's half of the net profits falls below $11,500, and Patrick has net profits to share. So Patrick is required to pay Katie $1,500 to get Katie to that $11,500 amount. If there was an endless amount of money, it would be different. But the contract has included clear subordinating language, a true-up formula, and an explicit aim of an equal 50-50 division of the community assets and liabilities.
Why can't we conclude that that subject to language in 4.5 just means that it refers to the claims that take priority in the event that Mr. Starling were to default on obligations to wife or to creditors?
Well, the challenge, Your Honor, if Patrick were to default, is that Katie and Patrick are still ultimately liable on this marital debt. And significantly, the Children's Trust is a co-borrower of privateer. So the Children's Trust, during the course of the marriage back in 2016, took out a loan from Plains Capital Bank That PCB note, as it's referred to in the record, had a cross-default provision. So if Patrick were to default under the privateer agreement, the trust would cross-default on every other loan, which would cause irreparable harm to the children's trust. So I think there's a significant concern if Patrick were to default. I'm sure that's not the outcome that Katie is looking for. I'm sorry, was there another part to your question, Your Honor?
No, that was my question. Just if the language that in 4.5, the subject to, I think Appley's point was essentially maybe it just referred to in the event that husband or that there was a default. It was a priority of creditor at that point just for that purpose.
Yes, Your Honor. Opposing counsel has referred to Katie as a creditor and, you know, speaks in the briefing about this idea of first lien, second lien. It's important to remember that Katie is not a creditor here. Katie is a passive investor in a shared investment that Patrick and Katie have taken on. In months in which there are net profits, Katie gets paid. In months in which there are no net profits, neither investor, Katie nor Patrick, get paid that month. One additional small point, Your Honor. Opposing counsel was talking about that Patrick could engage in some gamesmanship and, you know, basically hoard operating distributions. I just wanted to point out that there's nothing in the record that Patrick has exclusive control over when operating distributions go out. So when there is an operating distribution, Patrick has to make these deductions. Any net profits, he has to split with Katie 50-50.
We're not going to consider any speculation.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the court has no further questions, we'd ask the court to reverse summary judgment for Katie, grant summary judgment to Patrick, and remand for attorney's fees.
Okay, thank you, counsel. This case is submitted, and all of you are excused.
All right.